Pay no attention to the man behind the mask, Dorothy. His wisdom is illusory, his power defined by the degree to which he can get others to believe in his projected image. He is a bungler, a misfit, a carpetbagger with a master's degree in gimme from the University of Much Obliged, with a special emphasis on the cheerful disregard for the needs of others, as long as his sleep is not disturbed by their cries. In story, he is benign. In reality, his name is Legion. C. Wright Mills, obscure of birth in Texas close to the turn of the 20th century, would follow the yellow brick road to the seat of power in Washington and discover the wizard's true identity. Like Dorothy, his quest was to liberate, to unmask the fraud, to drag society from its quicksand of complacency with the unbreakable line of reason. Hello, I'm Haunani Singer, and this is From the Vault, an exclusive presentation of the Pacifica Radio Archives that brings our history out of the vault and onto the radio. This week we present C. Wright Mills.
So many intelligent academic people, both in Western Europe and in America, will not talk seriously about the politics of war and peace, of slump and boom, democracy and tyranny. They won't, or they can't, get beneath the official stereotypes. They favor such terms as specialty, as used in Not My Specialty.
C. Wright Mills was a child of the First World War, a chronicler of the Second. His view of the forces constructing these global cataclysms are the subject of this week's From the Vault. C. Wright Mills was an early champion of connective education over indoctrination, true intellectualism, the process by which each individual is educated to the possibilities of personal creativity and public contribution through the application of compassionate and pragmatic rationalism. Good thoughts rendering good deeds. Pacifica Radio Archives is proud to present this week, in our continuing dedication to the benefit and enlightenment of our community, this foundational insight into the ways of thought to set us truly free. This is not an echo. This is the Pacifica Radio Archives. This is From the Vault. And now we present this KPFA tribute documentary with Saul Landau, produced in 1962 by Elsa Knight Thompson, shortly after Mills' untimely death.
Pacifica Radio presents The Causes of C. Wright Mills.
These cold wires are the immediate and available enemy, colon. What they do and what they say means war. And it is war, comma, not the Russians, comma, that is the enemy of mankind today.
That was the voice of C. Wright Mills, dictating the first draft of the preface to the new edition of The Causes of World War III.
In the press of the various European and Asiatic countries in which this book has been published, as well as by cold warriors in North America, I have been severely taken to task for, quote, not really understanding the communist menace, unquote. Translated, this charge has usually meant, colon, paragraph. First, that I don't merely assume the official and quasi-official definitions of world reality, and in particular of Soviet reality, that form now a pervasive common denominator of belief in the NATO countries. Paragraph. Second, it means that many specific views of the Soviet
Union. One of Mills' closest associates was Saul Landau, who met him in Cuba, went with him to Europe and the Soviet Union, and worked as his editorial and research assistant on his last book, The Marxists.
C. Wright Mills had a heart attack on March 20th, 1962. No one really knows why it gave out at that time. He lived a very full life, much fuller than most people. True, he didn't do all he wished in his lifetime, and he certainly didn't write all the books he had in him. On both of these counts, the world is poorer. He was married 3 times. Each wife bore him a child. Mills didn't have too many close friends when he died. But the few that he had, they really loved him. He traveled a great deal through Europe, Latin America. He met many great people in his lifetime, and he enjoyed most of the earthly pleasures. Now, every intelligent person I know has read about or knows about at least some of the works of C. Wright Mills, and practically everyone has his own criticism. Liberals don't like the slightest innuendo about the United States being undemocratic or ruled by an elite with an elaborate and empty rhetoric. Conservatives just dismiss him as another pinko or communist. Marxists, American variety, pay proper homage, but of course he doesn't really make it because he doesn't follow the sloganized line. The democratic socialists, who once liked him, placed him in Nikita's camp. And finally, the Soviet versions of Arthur Schlesinger Jr.'s suspected that Mills was a Trotskyist at heart, although they publicly acclaimed him as an enlightened bourgeois. Mills was a revolutionary when he died. The heroes of his last book, The Marxists, are Lenin and Trotsky. How did he become a radical? This still bugs me. He was from Laredo County, Texas, which amused him. He had a grandfather who frequented whorehouses and was shot in the back. And when Mills himself was drunk, he sang the old blues, loud and off-key. His great passion was writing books that shook people up. Next, in no particular order, came food, liquor, motorcycles, carpentry, rifle shooting, dogs, camping equipment, sports cars, tumbling and wrestling. He was a man with many faults, hard to get along with, egotistical, short-tempered, and yet good-humored, sometimes bad-humored, loving, hating, brilliant most of the time, and sometimes petty. When I was a sophomore in college, I read White Collar, and I was really impressed by it. I had just become a Marxist, full of slogans, ready for debate, knowing all the answers to any question, and ready to dispute any question because it was always a bourgeois professor who asked it. Well, Mills hardly mentioned Marx in his book, but it was as devastating a commentary on U.S. society as any made by a Marxist. So from that time on, I followed his works very closely.
In the summer of 1960, Saul Landau was in Havana, where, like many other Americans, he was observing revolutionary Cuba firsthand.
I had just wandered into the Havana Riviera Hotel, partly to get out of the heat and into the air conditioning, and partly to see Bob Tabor of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee about some minor incident. I rang Tabor's room. He wasn't there, but the operator gave me a message to call another room. "This is Mills. Professor Mills," and I mumbled something about Tabor, and Mills invited me up for a drink. I think it was his size that first had me so scared. He was at least 6 feet tall and was overweight, at about 225. He moved quickly and decisively, and he smoked the pipe better than any commercial. He wasted no time. After the briefest amenities, he began to pump me. About 4 hours later, he had all I knew about Cuba, and some things I didn't think I knew. He had taken notes while we talked, and suddenly he jumped up. He put his notebook in his expensive safari jacket, slung 2 Nikons around his neck, and told me he had to go interview Che Guevara. "Well, see you at 8 at the bar for a drink, and don't be late." Well, when I arrived that night, Mills was sitting at a table with a group of American friends. They were sipping daiquiris and planter's punch. Mills was gulping them in one swallow. The conversation was usually superficial. Occasionally, someone made an interesting remark about Cuba. So Mills would quietly slip his pad out of his pocket and write it down. No one seemed to notice. You know, it didn't isolate him from the group or conversation. Finally, he said to me, "Listen, this guy who heads the education department is taking me to dinner tonight. You think I look all right?" His bush jacket was sweat-stained under the arms. His appearance was unique. He reminded me of Hemingway. "No," I said, "clothes aren't important around here." Armando Hart came with his wife, Aide Santa Maria, who was one of Fidel's original followers, and Juan Arcocha, my friend and Mills' interpreter. Hart was in his most conservative blue suit, Ide in an evening dress, and Juan in his usually spiffy, expensive Havana dinner clothes. Mills looked at me, and then at his bush suit. "I should have worn a tie," he said. Hart was shy and embarrassed, and the formal introductions were painful. I slipped away, and they went out. Even at this time, Mills's superiority as a man and as an intellect had really shaken me. And yet I felt that this dynamo of energy would burn itself out, or else be burnt out in frustration.
Juan Arcocha, who is now in Moscow as the correspondent for the Cuban paper Revolución, acted as Mills' interpreter while he was collecting material for Listen Yankee. Here is his story of that experience, which he sent to us from Cuba.
One afternoon in August 1960, Edie Santa Maria phoned me. Her husband Armando Hart, the Minister of Education, was supposed to dine that night with an American writer, and he needed an interpreter. I found someone to replace me at my job on the newspaper Revolución and went to the dinner to help Armando. The American writer was C. Wright Mills. That dinner had a tremendous impact on my life. I made contact with one of the most lucid minds of our generation. It was the beginning of a solid friendship, unfortunately, much too short a friendship. I was with him a few weeks after I met him when he was seized by a revolutionary conscience. With Mills, it wasn't hard for me to grow from the role of interpreter to that of friend and confidant. His mind was like a giant sponge. He understood all. He wanted to grasp everything. Nothing seemed to escape him. Everything interested him. And he could draw brilliant conclusions by cutting through the surface of everyday events. He told me how he decided to write the book that would later be published as Listen Yankee. When the triumph of Fidel Castro's bearded band brought the Cuban Revolution to the center of world attention, Mills began to clip articles about Cuba from newspapers and magazines. Then he filed them without giving them much attention. A few months later, on a trip to South America, journalists hit him with a barrage of questions about Cuba. The journalists seemed to be impassioned on the subject. From the tone of their questions, it became evident that the Cuban Revolution was something fundamental in American life. Mills felt embarrassed by his ignorance, by his inability to answer these questions. As soon as he returned to New York, he looked through his files for the material on Cuba. Reading it with attention, he discovered surprisingly that something very interesting was going on in Cuba. He decided to go there, to study it personally. The conclusions that he had drawn from the newspaper stories were very different from those which the U.S. press, which had already declared all-out war, offered to the American public. Mills felt obliged to tell his readers the truth about Cuba. Mills arrived in Cuba pondering a moral problem. He had thought about writing Listen Yankee in the first person. He wanted to speak through the mouth of a Cuban who would expound before the world his arguments and his grievances, the reasons for his fight, and the ideals that inspired him. The Cuban Revolution had been placed in the defendant's seat, and Mills wanted to change that by being its defense attorney. The idea tempted and frightened him at the same time. "By what right," he said to me one night, "can I speak in the name of the Cuban people? Doesn't it seem to you to be an absurd pretension on my part? Am I not just being conceited?" I told him no. When Listen Yankee was published, I felt great for having told him. Mills had a right to speak in the name of the Cuban people because he had made a superhuman effort to understand them, and he had earned it. Each day, our personal contact fascinated me more. His book showed that Mills was one of the most egg-headed intellectuals of North America, but he didn't fit the pigeonhole that I tried to put him in. He was an intellectual who thought nothing of climbing on a motorcycle, fixing the motor of a stalled car in the middle of the road to the Sierra Mestra, or watching with inexhaustible interest for a long time Fidel Castro having shooting practice with a group of soldiers from the rebel army. Because of the kind of intellectual that he was, Mills violently refused to allow himself to be divorced from life. One day, I felt I had finally captured the secret of his personality. We were near Manzanillo in Oriente Province. Mills was talking to Comandante René Vallejo in charge of the agrarian reform for the province. He was a well-known doctor in Manzanillo who one day abandoned his lucrative practice to go up to the Sierra and join Fidel. After the triumph of the revolution, he had abandoned his career to dedicate himself to agrarian reform. Realizing that Vallejo was one of the best surgeons in Cuba and a man in love with medicine, Mills figured that the act of abandoning it for the needs of the revolution ought to have produced a certain frustration. While I played with this idea, Mills told him right out, "You are a fortunate man. Already being a mature man, you have been able to give your life a new direction." He envied it. Vallejo's smile told me that he also considered himself a fortunate man. Some days later, we met again in Pinar del Rio province. We had spent the day with Fidel running around the province. At night, the three of us ate in a motel in the Vinayas Valley. After dinner, the conversation continued for many hours. Fidel and Mills passionately discussed the Cuban Revolution. A solid friendship was forming between those two very different men. For me, it was another unforgettable moment. Around midnight, we went to our shared room. Overtired by the long hours of translating, I couldn't sleep. In the darkness, I sensed Mills also wide awake in the next bed. At that point, he spoke to me. "What the hell am I doing here? I was very quietly writing a book in New York and thinking about the next one. All of a sudden, I decide to leave everything and come here to write the truth about Cuba. Now I have to confront myself with a lot of problems I didn't have before. Isn't that foolish? What do you think? Can you explain to me why I came here?" I was restrained by the fear of appearing pretentious or pedantic, but I couldn't resist the temptation to answer. "Yes, I think I can explain it. You yourself revealed the secret a few days ago when we talked with Vallejo. You are stirred by the temptation to change yourself into a man of action. All your life you wrote books about revolutions, and now you suddenly see yourself put right in the middle of a real revolution. You know that we have problems and that your experience and your intelligence could help us to solve them. You are a revolutionary who ignores yourself. If you envied Vallejo, it's because you'd like to do exactly what he's done." There was a minute of silence. In the darkness from the next bed, I heard Mills say to me, in an insecure voice, "Do you really think so?"
When Mills returned to the United States, he renewed contact with Saul.
Mills had always been a hard worker, at times compulsive. Listen Yankee was his 10th book, and he wrote it in 6 weeks. He did a first draft before he went to Cuba. This was based on all the reading. He read everything that was available. When I met him in Havana, he read it to me. And then after he spent a torrid 2 weeks interviewing Fidel for about 4 days, Che Guevara, Dorothy Coase, Raul Roa, and many lesser personalities, then he rewrote the entire thing. When he got back to the United States, he hounded Ian Ballantyne of Ballantyne Books into breaking all rules for publishing. Mills stayed up 16 hours a day finishing it. Then, when it was finished, he condensed it into an article for Harper's. He was really exhausted when I spoke to him in his Columbia office. This was in the fall of 1960. He was nervous and excited. He used to say, "My God, man, do you realize what has happened? We're going to break into the mass market. They're going to listen. We've hit on the new technique." Then he pulled it. "Do you know NBC wants me to debate A.A. Burley on nationwide TV? And he told me to collect everything I could find on Cuba and Latin America. Well, I told him I would, but he should rest a little first. But no, the chance to be on national television before about 20 million people, make Burley, who was a spokesman for the new frontier, to make Burley look like a fool, well, this intrigued him. He respected Burley's intellect. He felt that he was taking on an expert in Latin American affairs. But even in October, Mills already had a mine of information. This was the result of years of clipping and the widest variety of reading. He He must have had 400 pages of detailed notes. I used to come to his office every week, and we would talk. The Americans for Democratic Action had asked him to address their top intellectuals, and Mills agreed. He worked furiously preparing the speech. He wrote it, he rewrote it, cut it, recut it, edited it, and then he rewrote it again. It had information, biting sarcasm, and most important, it had real alternatives to the liberal policies and to the policies of the Eisenhower administration. Mills's eyes were ablaze. He used to guzzle pint after pint of black espresso coffee. He used to say, "My God, do you realize we've got them on the run?" He would laugh. He was confident. He was a little arrogant. He had so much vigor and force. Then his speech to the ADA, it was beautiful. They were furious. They practically accused him of being a communist. He was answering questions for hours on the platform. They baited him. They cursed him. And yet he stood there with the most compelling arguments, with proof, with facts, statistics, documentation of all kinds, and he didn't convince one of them. After it was over, he said, "Goddamn liberals, they are political idiots. Look, read this. Can you answer the speech?" I said, "No." In his fury, he found a good word for them, for the liberals. He was almost sputtering. He said, "Liberal obfuscators, obfuscators." Then he laughed. He was creating now. "I'm going to rack them up. Listen, that first chapter of the Marxists is going to rack them up, obfuscating bastards." Well, I sent him clippings and notes, and I spoke to him on the phone. He was still working from early in the morning till late at night. He was annoyed that he had to teach because it took time. The TV debate was scheduled for early in December of 1960. Mills felt that it would be a first and perhaps a last chance, not for him so much, but for a rational alternative to be presented to large numbers of people. TV would show what Burley's position was, suicide. It would present to all the new frontiersmen a reasonable and logical approach to Cuba and Latin America, a way out of a terrible situation. And finally, Mills had a pointed critique of past U.S. policy vis-à-vis Latin America. And Mills felt that it was up to him to do it. First of all, he was never a communist. In fact, he never belonged to any organization or group. Furthermore, as he always said, he was 100% American by birth, and he even had a trace of a southern accent. He was the only radical with a national reputation and a clean record, that is, no red connections. He was burdened by this responsibility. He worked more hysterically each day as the debate neared. Listen Yankee had been written in 6 weeks of frenzy, but his passion, it didn't cool. By early December, he had finally completed his preparations. He had enough material to write a definitive work on modern Latin America. I saw him about a week before the debate. He was nervous and he was still cramming. He was gulping black espresso and sharpening his architect's pencil. He used to say, "Here, read this stuff on Venezuela. Do you think I have Betancourt's significance worked out? I mean, as the last stopgap to any real change. Do I overlook something?" I tried to read, but he kept talking. He wanted reassurance and criticism. Well, finally, I finished it. It was a beautiful outline, filled with his imaginative slogans and metaphors. He had selected from more than 25 periodicals and God knows how many books. Finally, I finished. He said, "Well," I said, "I think it's great." But he said, "Burley must know all this stuff. He'll be able to counter it." But he didn't sound convincing. He smiled and he gulped espresso, his eyes always blazing. I said, "Why don't you take it easy? You can't keep up this pace. Relax, man." He says, "After the program, I'll goof off for a month. But, God, man, how do you expect me to rest?" He had a bad cough at this time, and his face was twitching. Everyone I knew was going to watch the debate. The afternoon of the big day, someone told me on the street that Mills had had a heart attack the night before. I didn't believe it. I just pushed it out of my mind. I refused to believe it. We turned on the TV set. The announcer said that Mills couldn't make it because he was ill. Everyone was shocked. Everyone felt like turning the set off. We didn't, for some reason. Burley waltzed through the debate with Congressman Porter. It was a farce. And Mills was in some hospital, practically dead.
When Listen Yankee appeared in paperback, it did indeed, as Mills had prophesied, hit the mass market. At least 400,000 copies were sold. About 300,000 more than books of this type, even successful ones, usually sell. Ian Ballantyne, his publisher, recorded this for Pacifica.
I met C. Wright Mills when he was teaching at Columbia. My brother was in his class. And Mills was at that time at work on White Collar. He asked me questions about publishing, and in that way I got to know him a little. He had wonderful vitality. He inspired a class. And I liked him, thinking at that time, very foolishly, that this was a book that a professor was writing and that I couldn't make any move towards it. When some years later he had the desire to get a book to a broad audience about what he called the drive and thrust towards war, he approached me, and out of that came The Causes of World War III. I worked with him on the manuscript of that book and on the manuscript of Listen, Yankee. He was extremely eager that he reach people. He was not at all interested in fortifying an academic reputation. He wanted to show that he had worked on what he was writing about. But he didn't care at all about the normal academic politics. He was, in some ways, a lonely man, a man who didn't meet people easily. And part of this was that he worked so hard. He was to have debated on a TV program, The Nation's Future. And his preparation for that was to get a notebook, so he had key facts on every South American country. That notebook, which he prepared for that hour's broadcast, itself is almost a book. He would get up early, bolt a kind of mixed-up raw egg and orange juice, and work solidly the whole day. He was very neat. He had Danish filing system in his den or office. And everything in each drawer was all in good order, and there were several hundred drawers. He clipped a lot, relying heavily on the New York Times. He would write little remarks to himself in the margins of the story. This man with this wonderful energy had, I think, a realization that he had to get through. He felt driven and worried, anxious about the problem of getting through. And because he had a fairly large number of people who understood his books and responded to him in such a way that he found that the books were being understood, he got great reinforcement from that. He did not accept ever for 1 minute nonsense. In other words, he didn't say to himself, I am going to be, now I am a well-known writer and professor, I am going to influence government by going along with some idiotic idea just so that he might bend it in some constructive direction and find himself rationalizing all kinds of vicious or wrong-headed doings. He, for this reason, was not popular with anyone who had reached any kind of position of influence, because usually that person had worked out some kind of rationalization as to why they were part of the establishment. And Mills was standing there to show that you didn't have to do that. The people who knew him and liked him loved him as a man. He had all kinds of boyish interests. Terrific motorcycle, shopsmith set up, was interested in guns, interested in camping. He got one of these Volkswagen buses, all custom fitted out with things he made himself for it. I have the feeling as a tremendous sense of loss. I don't know who there is in this country who stands to come into Mills's place, either as a thinker or as a writer.
Perhaps, as Mr. Ballantyne said, Mills felt he must work as rapidly as possible in what time he had left, for he pressed on with the Marxists.